Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Acclaimed author Lionel Shriver, author of the National Book Award finalist So Much for That, The Post Birthday World, and the psychological novel We Need to Talk About Kevin, now a major motion picture, probes the mystery of charisma in a new novel that teases out the intimate relationship between terrorism and cults of personality, explores what makes certain people so magnetic, and reveals the deep frustrations of feeling overshadowed by a life of the party who may not even be present. It is a great pleasure to welcome Lionel Shriver to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
The name of the new novel is The New Republic. This has a fascinating backstory because this is a book you wrote many years ago, and it's just seeing the light of day.
That's right. I finished it in 1998, and I did try to get it published. And I think the reasons that I didn't succeed were probably two. One of them was obvious. I was commercial poison. I had the equivalent in publishing of a criminal record. So no one was leaping at the next Lionel Shriver manuscript to come through the transom. But the other reason's a little more interesting. We tend to forget, but in the late 90s, we just didn't take terrorism seriously as a domestic American problem.
So that brings up two questions, and one that came through to me very quickly in the book. How much revising did you do to release this novel in a post-9/11 world?
Very little. One of the reasons that I am very clear and upfront about the fact that this is a 1998 novel is that I want credit for being ahead of the curve, because I was writing about this subject both in fiction and nonfiction for many years before it became, you know, so central to American politics. And, you know, you can't have it both ways. If I want that kind of credit, then I can't insert insightful paragraphs with the benefit of hindsight. That would be cheating. So while I tightened it up a little bit and I added one thing that readers will readily recognize at the very end of the book, just a tiny detail, mm-hmm. I kept the substance and the sentiments in the novel the same.
You were living in Ireland, Northern Ireland, when you
wrote
The New Republic.
In Belfast.
What was the relationship of being in Belfast and ultimately writing a book about terrorism?
It was very frustrating to live year after year up close against the ugly reality that terrorism works. I was constantly seeing the IRA in particular getting concessions from the British government, having secret negotiations behind closed doors, in spite of the fact that the Brits were always protesting that they didn't negotiate with terrorists. And also to see these people be so important, you know, exert so much power, get so much attention, and in some places, admiration. And I found them, by and large, quite unpleasant as people. And certainly their methods were unpleasant. And I hated seeing those methods pay off. And it's from that frustration that this book derives. But I've written all kinds of op-eds saying, you know, this is important. We can't have this kind of bad behavior pay off. But I needed a new approach because the sincere, earnest thing was not working. And this book goes at the subject in a fictional place. It's on a peninsula of Portugal that doesn't really exist. I just drew this little landmass onto the country. Mm. And I made up the politics. I made up my own terrorist group called the SOB. And removing it from Northern Ireland meant that I could be much more playful. No one was going to take offense about, you know, my offending one side or the other in a fictional conflict. And it gave me a lot of latitude. It also made it possible to use humor, which I find makes any book go down a treat.
I want to talk more about the humor in just a moment. I assume many listeners may be wondering why you did not write about Northern Ireland specifically, and I assume it's because you had already written about Northern Ireland.
I'd already written a book set in Northern Ireland. My my third novel, Ordinary Decent Criminals, is set there. So I didn't want to repeat myself. But beyond that, you know, I was sick of it. I was sick of the whole thing. And that's very common there. That was, by that point, common everywhere. Everyone was sick of Northern Ireland. It had been going on for 30 years. So at that stage of the game, there was no better formula for failure and commercial nonentity than setting a book in Belfast.
So the book we have, The New Republic, is light. It has a lighter tone. There is a tone of satire and of farce. It is not overly heavy. It is not moralistic. You're not decrying the evils of terrorism. But obviously all the ingredients are there. Would this have been a different book had you written it post 9/11?
I might not have written this novel post 9/11. I would have been discouraged from going at the topic at all. And I might have been more nervous about approaching it with that lightness. But I'm glad I wrote it ahead of time, and I do think this is a book whose time has come. It has been 10 years. I'm hoping that our sensibilities have grown a little more robust, that we can take a joke now. I look at a film like Four Lions, which is a British film about Islamic terrorists, which is absolutely hilarious. And that suggests to me that, you know, maybe the moratorium on cracking wise is over. Furthermore, I'm now getting to the point where I'm evangelical about humor in relation to terrorism. I think there's a way in which we need to take our own sensibility back. We need to reassert the way we Westerners look at the world. And we look at the world and find it funny on occasion. It's one of the things that makes the unbearable bearable. And everything I see coming out of terrorist groups, it seems to be the one uniform quality that unites them, regardless of the cause, is that they have no sense of humor whatsoever. And most of all, they have no sense of humor about themselves. And I feel that the one thing that they are most vulnerable to is being laughed at.
At the beginning of the book, you use Canadian and British press baron and Conrad Black's quote about journalists being ignorant, lazy, opinionated, and intellectually dishonest. What do you make of that quote, and why was it so important for you to use it?
Well, this is a novel that goes at journalists as well as everybody else. And I like the irony that it was Conrad Black who said that. Talk about a pot calling the kettle black, if you will.
Because that in and of itself is hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, that's this book, right? I have to say that since I wrote this novel, I have grown more defensive of journalists. This is perhaps not the best era to be defensive of them, given the whole Rupert Murdoch News of the World scandal. But, you know, proper foreign correspondents are becoming an endangered species. And I'm very dependent on foreign correspondents for my information. And as I see newspapers shrinking around me, I begin to fear for them, you know. So I make fun of them in this book. They can be awfully pretentious, awfully full of themselves and pompous and showing off all the places they've been in and all the incredible danger that they've survived. Fair enough, you know, and I think that's a point well taken. But I am now much more defensive of them because I don't want them to go away. They can be as pompous as they like, as far as I'm concerned, as long as they continue to report the news. I need that news. I'm a journalist of the sort that I think everyone can live without. I write features. I do book reviews. You know, who cares? What we really need is people out there getting information and reliable information that's been double-checked.
Does part of your, I think many of us have that need and we want the information. You were born in the States, you live in London. Does that have something to do with it as well, to have that connection?
Connection to?
To where you live, to where you lived.
Well, in some ways I have the best of both worlds because I go back and forth between New York and London. I enjoy a larger perspective, I think, because I have a connection to Europe. And therefore, news in that part of the world is more meaningful to me than it would be if I just stayed in the U.S. But I keep a foothold in U.S. politics as well. So, you know, whenever I come back to the U.S., I turn on CNN and watch Anderson Cooper or what have you and try to catch up on what's happening here. It's been very interesting to be back during this Trayvon case.
What do you make of that?
You know, that's interesting you ask, because this is an information issue, and I feel I don't have the information.
Right.
And
well, I think many of us feel that way, right? I mean, we want to know more information, but they just came out with a police report a few days ago, but it really didn't tell us anything. And then you wonder, why did it take us 6 weeks before we got the police report?
It's obviously one of those issues that, you know, different groups, dangerously, it can be whites and blacks, are inclined to believe different stories. And therefore, the facts get lost in the shuffle. So I have studiously tried not to leap to judgment.
Going back to the publication of this book and ultimately writing the manuscript and having it be rejected in 1998, did that surprise you? As you said, I believe you used the word poison, didn't you? But did you feel that there was more to it than that?
Well, you know, at that stage, I certainly wasn't surprised by any rejection. I was getting used to it. I was a little disheartened to reach the conclusion that after I don't know how many submissions, I should give up and move on to the next book. But ironically, that sense of depression and feeling that maybe my career was on the skids and I would have to figure out something else to do with my life, that whole dark cloud was a great assist for writing the next book, which was We Need to Talk About Kevin. And that entailed inhabiting the mind of the mother of one of these high school killers who'd killed several people at his high school and was trying to figure out whether or not her lack of love for her own son bore some of, if not all of, the blame for his atrocity. And obviously, she's not in a very good mood. So being disheartened myself and gloomy helped me to enter her mindset. And it also proved a funny antidote for self-pity, because in comparison to her plight, I didn't sell my last novel, seemed pretty paltry.
It was 2003 when We Need to Talk About Kevin came out, as you say, about a high school shooter. Also rejected by many publishers before it was picked up, and it was picked up by a small British publisher initially. What do you think it was about the story that you just outlined that eventually struck such a chord?
I think by sheer accident, I landed on an issue whose time had arrived. I mean, for some reason, at that point, women were really ready to talk about the downside of motherhood and what it was like to wrestle with whether or not to have a child in an era when, you know, it is a choice. It is not necessary that we have children. We can get away with it, and there's not a lot of opprobrium heaped on women who decide not to. And, of course, it's a big nature versus nurture book. We live in an era where, despite the fact that genetics is discovering more and more that elements of character are, to a degree, predetermined. But in the social sciences and in the newspaper, parents get the blame for everything. I think that we hold parents more responsible than ever for the way their children come out. And this is a novel that asks the question, which is it? Are parents really responsible for everything, or do they sometimes get saddled with children who, from birth, are difficult or even wicked?
Did your writing life change at all as a result of the success of the book eventually, as well as the film?
I'm not sure it had an enormous effect on my writing life. After all, my writing life, what? It's just sitting in front of a computer, podging at keys. It's pretty dumpy, really. I mean, I get more offers to write journalistic assignments. There's that.
And people go back and read what you've written in the past.
Well, that's been gratifying. It redeems the effort of writing earlier books now that they're finding a larger audience. And that's been the biggest difference, is that I feel I have an audience. And that's great. That's a big improvement. I'm not one of those fiction writers who really writes for herself. No, I don't. I mean, if I'm going to write for myself, I'm going to write a grocery list, or I'm going to, you know, pour out my heart in my journal, but I'm not going to bother to fashion an actual novel. So now that I write a book, I'm fairly assured that at least a handful of people will read it. And that's definitely an improvement for me.
So in the New Republic, you have this political opportunist who is building up this party around this the phantom terrorists. But you also, obviously, as we talked about, the journalists are looking at this and they're very excited over a story that they don't realize doesn't actually exist. And as a correspondent, as a journalist, is that laziness? Is that what that is?
It was not meant to be laziness so much. I mean, I'm looking at the way in which journalists and terrorists have a symbiotic relationship. And in a way, they need each other insofar as journalists always need news. And most news is bad. But terrorists really need journalists in order to get the message out. If a bomb blows up in a forest and nobody hears it, does it really happen? You need all that press to make an impact. And in that way, there's a relationship between the New Republic and We Need to Talk About Kevin, because the same is true for school shooters. They need that magnification. One of the things that drives people to both blow themselves up and shoot up their school is imagining the kind of outsized press they're going to get once the atrocity comes to pass. I mean, I think that's one of the major motivations is, oh, the headlines, your face on the front page, your face on the television news, everyone in the comment pages pouring over your terrible problems, whether they be political or personal. And so the press is complicit. The press actually, they have the prize. They deliver the prize. And I don't know what the answer to this is, because I am not a big believer in press censorship. So I wouldn't want us to say, well, because you cover these things, it inspires other people to do the same, so you can't cover them anymore. That's not on in a free society.
Doesn't it frustrate you that the next step isn't made? When you look at the organization and you look at this terrorist group and this terrorist act, to make the next step and to investigate it more and to see that if there is a rock-throwing incident, that it's being done for the sake of terrorism as opposed to being done for the television cameras?
Well, I actually saw in Belfast kids who would stage a riot just because there was television around. Honestly, riots would happen that wouldn't have otherwise happened because they would actually perform for the camera. So that the camera came first.
But is it a journalist's job to say that what is being done right now is being done because we're here? Or are they saying, let's run it because it's good television?
Well, of course they're going to run it if it's good television. And you can't really blame them. I mean, that is their job. The one thing I did do myself on this point is I had become something of a considered expert on school shooting, which is a little, I'm sorry, it's ridiculous. I made one up, so I'm an expert, great. And so every time there was another one of these incidents, I would get dragged onto five different news programs to explain why it happened or to essentially just fill airtime, because nobody ever quite knows what to say about these things except, well, that was awful. And that's not enough. You know, it doesn't take up very much time. One of the only things I felt I could bring to the table in these interviews was to say consistently what I'm saying now, that these kids are, if you like, performing for the camera. Even the kids that end up killing themselves or trying to kill themselves are motivated by the idea of posthumous glory. Well, when I said this enough times, I realized I was part of the problem, that even in making that observation, I was still providing the kind of attention and therefore reinforcement that I was decrying. Well, the short word for that is hypocrite, and I stopped giving those interviews.
One of the things that came through in We Need to Talk About Kevin, for me, it was such a powerful book, but that whole question of evil, of being an inherently evil, and how much of that is from the beginning, the bad seed, or does our culture nurture that?
Of course, that's the whole question the book poses, and it does not answer it.
No.
And that, to me, is more interesting. I think
Absolutely.
That's why it's been such a successful book club book, because it leaves the central question open-ended. And that means that it's up to the reader to make his or her own mind up what the truth is. And readers always have violent opinions on this point, you know, but they don't all agree with each other. So book clubs become these knockdown, drag-out arguments about whose fault it is and whether Kevin was evil from birth or whether it's all his mother's fault. I've occasionally seen these in action. It's great entertainment. I love to watch.
Do you ever see yourself writing a book that is not about a large, controversial, or numbing issue?
Numbing. Well, that doesn't sound very appealing, does it? I don't feel that fiction necessarily has to attach to some larger social issue in order to be important or effective or enjoyable reading. So I happen to be somebody who is a real news junkie, and I enjoy books that occasionally do connect up with big issues. But I far prefer, even in my own work, a book that intersects with both the public and the private. And I would say The New Republic is typical in that respect, because, I mean, we've spent most of our time talking about the terrorist element of the novel, but if anything, the larger issue in the book is much more private. And it's about this business of what is it that makes certain people so bizarrely magnetic? And, you know, what secret do they have that we don't have? What is it about the person who, if he doesn't come to your party, the party's going to be a bust? Why do we need them so much? What do they seem to offer? And it goes further and asks the question, who's really got a better deal? The admired person, the person that others look up to so much and whose company we covet, or the admirer? Is the experience of looking up to someone, is that not itself quite rich, and in some ways perhaps richer than the potentially hollow and frightening experience of being looked up to yourself? I think that being admired is complicated, and it can be embarrassing. It can also make you feel like a fraud.
Not being genuine.
Well, it's, you know, when you are admiring someone, you know you're being genuine. I mean, that comes from the heart. But being admired, it can be baffling, and you privately often worry that other people are making you into something that you're not.
What is next for you? Are you at work on the next novel?
Yes, I'm almost finished with my next book. It's probably going to be out about a year from now, and it's called Big Brother. And it does pick up a social issue, but it's, again, also very private, and that's obesity.
Lionel Shriver's new novel is The New Republic. It is published by HarperCollins. Lionel Shriver, it's always a pleasure to have you on this program. I thank you so much, and I wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you so much.
Again, Lionel Shriver's new book is The New Republic. It is published by HarperCollins. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.